Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battlespace of the war for the free world, a man very much in the trenches of the front lines of that war, is our first guest, Dr. Barry Rubin. He joins us from the Gloria Center, which he directs in Herzliya, Israel. He is the author of numerous books, including Israel, An Introduction, and the definitive account of the Muslim Brotherhood. What we're up to embracing these guys is very much on our mind at the moment. Barry Rubin, welcome. It's good to talk with you. I'd like to start with the piece that you wrote about the president's head in the sand speech last week at the National Defense University. Tell us what your thoughts are about what he said and what sort of the implications of it might be.
It's a completely new position on the situation with international terrorism. Up until now, as you know, the Obama administration has been maintaining that al-Qaeda is finished. It's in defeat and decline and so on. But that position is no longer tenable. So they have a totally new position, which is this. The central office, central force of al-Qaeda is on the run and been defeated, but they must acknowledge two other things. The first of those is that al-Qaeda has spread to other countries, Yemen and Syria and so on. The second is that there is the influence of al-Qaeda. In other words, let's say that the murder in the streets of London, the Boston bombing and other things. Actually, he even said the Fort Hood shooting, in contradiction actually to what the Defense Department said the next day, that these are due to the influence of al-Qaeda. The influence of al-Qaeda, however, is put like on a lower level. It's not as important. It's not as bad. It doesn't quite count as much. So they had to admit that the forces of international terrorism are still strong without associating it with any radical Islamist political development. So my third point is that there's absolutely no connection to strategic issues. So I coined the phrase that the Obama administration position is that to win the war on terrorism, you must lose the war on revolutionary Islamism, or to put it another way, that only the coming to power of moderate Islamists can defeat al-Qaeda, as in you send a thief to catch a thief. There are lots of points left out of this, one of which, of course, is that the taking over of entire countries by what I would call radical Islamist groups is a tremendous strategic defeat for the U.S. The second is that aside from al-Qaeda, there are also the radical Salafist groups, that they're very anti-American, that is the Muslim Brotherhood. So it just negates the strategic aspects here. And over and over again, I've tried to explain to people that it is possible to understand very clearly what the Obama administration thinks or its policy is based on, and that is al-Qaeda is bad because they want to attack America directly, but the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups are good because they don't want to attack the World Trade Center. They don't want to attack America directly, and therefore the United States should help them, at least up to a point. This is what the Obama policy is.
Barry Rubin, let me just ask you to drill down on that for a moment, because you understand, of course, the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood probably as well as anybody on the planet. Is there a dime's worth of difference in terms of the goals? I grant you that they may have different tactical approaches, but in terms of the goals of imposing Sharia worldwide and reestablishing the caliphate between these so-called non-threatening Muslim Brotherhood types and other Salafists and jihadists and so on, and those that we associate explicitly with the violent jihadists of al-Qaeda?
Well, without saying 100% yes, let me just say pretty much yes, largely yes. The key issue is tactical. and there have always been in the modern history of radical Islamism two different tactics. One tactic is attack the near enemy first. That is, attack the regimes that rule countries which have Muslim majorities. And the other tactic, which was embraced by Al-Qaeda, was attack the far enemy first. That is, attack the U.S. directly and show that it's powerless. But, by the way, was in a real sense exactly what Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution were doing by taking people in the embassy hostage. Now, the reason Al-Qaeda adapted that strategy is that at that time in history, the Islamists had failed completely. There had not been any Islamist revolutions after Iran, except because of Afghanistan. So that was a point of failure. So then they said, we need to change our strategy, and they did. And then later developments, partly due to Al-Qaeda's change of strategy, allowed the return to the near-enemy strategy. And, of course, now they control in different ways the countries of Turkey, Tunisia, Egypt, Sudan, not a country, the Gaza Strip, Iran, and probably Syria. So that's the basic difference.
Libya as well.
No, I definitely would not. Libya does not have an Islamist government. What it has is the freedom of operations of Islamist militias. And that's also a very important point, because even if what the Obama administration say, nice, good Muslim Brotherhood governments take over, the Salafists, and in some cases Al-Qaeda, can still run free. So actually there are three problems. One, government by the Muslim Brotherhood. Two, the operation of Salafists. And three, the operations of Al-Qaeda. So what they're doing is they're increasing the number of problems from one to three.
I take the point that you've made about Libya. I'm afraid it may, in the great scheme of things, be a nuance when the practical effect is to have Al-Qaeda-like elements as well as the Brotherhood and so on operating now with impunity from a country that still is awash with weapons and strategically located and oil-rich and so on.
And which is an American client.
Ostensibly an American client, certainly one that we helped create in its present form. Speaking of which, we have John McCain, one of the architects of that effort to liberate Libya from a man he had not so long before embraced, Muammar Gaddafi, now treating with the Syrian opposition. Tell us what you make of that, Dr. Barry Rubin of the Gloria Center in Hitsilia, and in where you think that probably leaves the United States if this putative national security leader of the loyal opposition in this country is singing from this playbook.
Well, look, it's a real-world paradox. On the one hand, you have Bashar al-Assad, who is an ally of Iran and Hezbollah, and is anti-American and is very repressive. On the other hand, you have the rebels who, I'm sorry, I wish it were otherwise, are dominated by radical Islamists who would be repressive and are allies of the Sunni Islamists. Now, if one side had to win, for various reasons, I could explain, take the rebels. But there's not a huge difference from the position of U.S. strategic thing. So does the United States want to put into power radical Salafists, including a very strong Al-Qaeda element? Is this worth doing? Now, people are suffering in Syria, but I don't think if the rebels took over, they're going to stop suffering.
I don't think so either. And Barry, the question is indeed not only of this paradox, but the prospect that we're going to see much more in the way of armaments flowing there is likely to make the lot of life of civilians considerably worse. Well, talk to me quickly, if we can, with less, about a minute or so to go, Barry Rubin, about the EU's decision, such as it was, messy as it was, to end the arms embargo that the European nations have imposed on Syrian rebels to this point.
Well, ending the arms embargo doesn't mean sending a lot of arms. I mean, I think that most people view the situation as this. The change in Western policy in the arms supply is not sufficient to bring victory to the rebels. It will merely ensure an ongoing deadlock, which may continue for 2 years, in the fighting. If they want to bring victory to the rebels, they're going to have to do a lot more. So basically, the Western decision is meaningless. And because, in part, there isn't more enthusiastic support for the rebels, because now they've come to a realization of who the rebels are, and it poses a big problem when a specific individual who you're supporting militarily eats parts of a Syrian soldier who's just been murdered.
Unsavory, to say the least.
That's a symbol of the situation.
Barry Rubin, thank you very much for this appreciation of the challenges we're facing in the Middle East, from the Middle East. We look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Claire Lopez. We'll get her take on what happened when that barbarism was played out in London. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you never listen to Mike Gallagher visiting with Chris Wallace, you don't know what you're missing.
I don't like the Olympics. I'm not
Why?
A big Olympics fan.
Because they get sweaty?
No, because I just don't. I only care about stuff in our own country. I don't care about the Olympic Games. I don't.
How about the United States winning? How about USA?
That's why I go to a football game.
This has been a particularly moronic effort.
Volatile stuff. Got you all fired up.
The Mike Gallagher Show. Weekdays at 9, right before Dennis Prager at noon on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claire Lopez. She was a career Central Intelligence Agency officer for 20 years in many of the most colorful, shall we say, places around the world. She has become, in her years subsequent to leaving the service, one of the country's leading experts on the threat of jihad and Sharia, and most especially that practiced and abetted by the Iranians. And Claire Lopez, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, though what we talk about is often unsettling, to say the least. And I just wanted to say that in the segment preceding yours, we talked at the very end with Barry Rubin about the barbarism of jihad. And I'd like to sort of get you to talk a little bit about that as you've studied it and been exposed to it, in particular, maybe starting with what we saw last week on the streets of London and what it might mean for the rest of us.
Well, yes, Frank, thank you. And I'm very glad to be with you again, too, of course. The attack in London, which was by all accounts, a barbarous attack by two young Muslim British individuals of Nigerian background, cutting down and hacking to death a British soldier on the streets of London, and practically beheading him, apparently, was horrific. And then I think what struck many people who saw the incident on TV and the video that the one individual shot on the street after the murder, he did not run away. They didn't try to escape. They calmly stood there on the street, talked with passersby, and wanted to be filmed talking about their justification for what they had done as they waited for the police that eventually showed up. And the comments that we saw in that film by this young suspect is the murderer, with hands bloody, holding the knives and the machete that he used to kill the soldier, Lee Rigby.
The Face of Jihad. We're joined once again by Claire Lopez. She is a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, also with the Gatestone Institute, a woman who draws on a wealth of experience earned during her years of service in the Central Intelligence Agency. And Claire, you were talking about sort of the barbaric quality of the characters that engaged in this brutal murder of a British soldier in Britain. Tell us a little bit more about what that means, not just for the Brits, but how it is beginning to manifest itself similarly in violent action elsewhere in Europe.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is that the horror of the attack itself perhaps was only exceeded by the comments of the murderer afterwards on film, in which he justified his actions by quoting from the Quran, talking about taking a life for a life, claiming that the British in battlefields like Iraq and Afghanistan were murdering Muslims. And so I think what you're seeing is the response to Al-Qaeda's call for individual jihad, which is what this is, and it's going to be repeated elsewhere. We're going to see other incidents. Certainly, perhaps copycat attack that took place in France, in Paris, was a reflection of that. Now, of course, the outbreak of the violence in Sweden, it has shocked many in Europe and Sweden, of course, too, with its violence, with its how long it's been going on. We're seeing an uprising. We're seeing a gathering of the forces of Islam, jihad and Sharia forces. And they feel empowered at this point in time for many reasons. But they are answering the call put out by Al-Qaeda, and drawing on Islamic law and scripture and history as their justification.
Claire Lopez, let me ask you, I talked with Barry a bit about this as well. To what extent do you believe that what we're seeing in part, you say there are many impetuses that are contributing to this rising sense of assertiveness and confidence on the part of these jihadists. But to what extent do you think that our own government's posture, policies, attitudes, and conduct, including most recently this speech by the president at National Defense University last week, is contributing to that?
I think it contributes a great deal. The posture of the West as viewed by the forces of Islam right now is weak. And there is a complete lack of determination to even name or acknowledge the forces that are coming against us of Islamic Jihad and Sharia, much less to confront them. And the speech by President Obama at the National Defense University last week was a good example of this, in which he essentially said, the war on terror is over, and it's over because I want it to be over. Not because the forces have given up. The forces that are fighting against us have given up. They have not. As we can see, they're accelerating their attacks, if anything.
Well, and Claire, I know we're catching you in a noisy spot, and we appreciate very much your taking a few minutes with us to talk about these very important issues. In your study of the Sharia doctrine, and you were, of course, a contributor to the very important Sharia, the Threat to America, Team B2 report. To what extent is it clear that the doctrine that these jihadists embrace and seek to impose on the rest of us demands that they redouble their efforts
to force those like us, infidels like us, to submit to their will when they see us behaving in such a submissive fashion.
Absolutely. That is the way they see the world. That is the way that they think of their doctrine and their scriptures. And of course, back to London, Adebolajo, Michael Adebolajo, the one that was caught on film, quoting directly from the Quran about, you know, taking an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. In other words, revenge as he saw it for British actions in other fields of battle. But the point you're making is a good one, that when they see weakness and they see an opening or they see an advantage to be gained, they're going to drive for it. They're not going to greet a concession with a concession or a speech like the president's declaring, you know, backing off from the war on terror. That isn't going to encourage them to reciprocate likewise. They will redouble their efforts. They will press the advantage, and we will see an acceleration in attacks.
And Claire, finally, to what extent does the kind of behavior that you're talking about now evident, as you said, not just in London, but elsewhere in Europe, including in a particularly graphic way in Sweden, where riots took place in something like 15 cities across Sweden recently at the hands of these jihadists? Are we really witnessing kind of where this sort of Sharia movement seeks to take all of us, including those of us here in the United States? Is this, in other words, a foretaste of what's likely to come here?
I'm afraid that it certainly could be. I mean, nobody would suspect, would have suspected previously that Sweden would be hit with this kind of massive violence. It does go in some sense to immigration and immigration policies. Sweden, of course, like other Nordic countries and Europeans, you know, have been very open and welcoming. So has Canada, so has the United States. But when that population is here, as the Muslim Brotherhood writes and declares that it is here as part of a civilization jihad or a settlement process, then you begin to put into perspective what this is about. And it is not about assimilation or coming here to enjoy the advantages and the opportunities of a free Western society, although it is for some. The ones on the streets, it's a different story. So the Muslim Brotherhood, they've told us quite explicitly, it is a settlement process and a civilization jihad.
It is indeed. Claire Lopez, we appreciate your study and expertise in this matter, and that you are working tirelessly to help the rest of us understand what we're facing, not just someplace else, not just in the Middle East, not just in Europe, but as you say, here in America as well. And your assistance in trying to protect us against this threat is deeply appreciated. Keep up the good work. Next up, we'll be talking with Andy McCarthy about the speech and John McCain's adventures in Syria and much more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Do you ever wonder if America has been, to coin a phrase, fundamentally transformed from a country that reveres individual liberty to one that promotes the collective? Surely Barack Obama is encouraging socialism here and empowering those who hate freedom both at home and abroad. But Diana West, one of our most brilliant and articulate writers, is publishing today a dynamite new book that documents how this ominous transformation actually began with Franklin Roosevelt and is simply reaching new and dangerous heights under Team Obama. Every American patriot should read American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. As Diana West makes clear, this betrayal of our country and its essential character may have been going on for a while, but it must not be allowed to continue any longer. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Andy McCarthy, the best-selling author of, among other things, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, a very prescient piece indeed. He is also the author of countless extraordinarily thoughtful, articulate, and timely opinion pieces, analyses, and the like at National Review Online and PJ Media, a former federal prosecutor and a man we turn to each week with the greatest of pleasure. Thank you, Andy, for joining us as always.
Frank, it's my pleasure. How are you?
Great, thank you. Despite adversity which surrounds us, and I want to talk with you a little bit about it, I've been taking stock with some of our duty experts on the subject about the speech, President Obama's address to the National Defense University last week. You had some critical thoughts on the subject, and I'd welcome you sharing them with us now.
Well, I just think that President Obama's speech was maddening in some ways because for what I regard as the first time, I could be wrong about that because he has made statements all over the map, but, you know, we had the president who has purged terms like jihad from the government's lexicon, actually speaking as if he were himself the scourge of jihad, freely invoking it, and even acknowledging that the terrorism that is directed against the United States is fueled by an ideology that is the belief system of Muslim extremists, which is all true. And then, you know, he gets to the bottom line and he basically says that the ideology is built on a lie. And the lie in his mind is they say that their it's their ideology that makes them hostile to America and the West and induces them to be at war with America in the West. And it's built on a lie because, drum roll, we're not at war with them, which, of course, has nothing to do with whether or why they consider themselves to be at war with us.
Any more than the idea that if we're going to stop fighting the war, that the war will be over if they're still at war with us.
I was reminded of, you know, one time I had a case against a woman who was a terrorist with the Weather Underground, and she was represented by a high-profile white shoe law firm in Washington. And the lawyer, among other arguments he made, was that she couldn't be a terrorist. And when I asked why she couldn't be a terrorist, she had been, after all, convicted of terrorism, he said that their firm didn't represent terrorists, and they were representing her.
Oh, well, that took care of that.
So that's I kind of got a flashback to that listening to President Obama. The other thing he said was that, you know, the war in Afghanistan is coming to an end. And I'm sitting here wondering, well, has anyone told the Taliban that? Because, you know, it seems to be news to them.
Well, no, I think it's not news to them. They know it's coming to an end, and they're winning. And,
yes,
and that
well,
was sort of
exactly
my takeaway from this speech, is that it was more a surrender of document than anything else.
Right. You're so right about that. I mean, the fact of the brute bottom line here is that wars are won or lost. You know, you don't get to just say, it's over, we're leaving now, and we won.
Andy, one of the guys who has been something of a bête noire for you over the years because of his foolishness, let's be honest, is engaging in much the same kind of nonsense, not understanding the nature of the enemy, enabling them, legitimating them, and otherwise compounding the damage that's being done by the Obama administration, because he is, at least to hear most press accounts tell it, the leader of the Republican Party on national security affairs. Needless to say, I'm speaking of John McCain, senator from Arizona. We learned over the weekend that he was treating with the opposition in Syria. You've taken a very dim view of our engagement there. What did you make of the latest McCain antic, and what should we as a party, as conservatives in particular, think of his role in essentially embracing and abetting, in its fashion, what Mr. Obama is up to?
Well, you know, I don't understand why the Republican Party looks to Senator McCain for guidance on national security matters. I think he's been wrong at least as often as he's been right. And, you know, when he's been right, it's he hasn't exactly been a singular voice. I really don't understand why, after everything that's gone on in Libya in the last 18 months to 2 years, anybody would follow McCain into Syria, where basically he wants to do the same thing as he urged President Obama to do in Libya. And look, I don't to try not to bash Senator McCain here for just a second. I don't think anybody doubts, or anybody sensible doubts, that there are elements in the Middle East, in Syria in particular, even in Libya, that are pro-American and pro-Western. And we would like to do what can be done responsibly under the circumstances to try to empower those people if we can. But we have to take the region as it is, not as Senator McCain would imagine it. And as it is, you know, our allies in that region are outnumbered by a margin of at least 4-1 or 5-1. And to think that you could take Assad out without the contribution of the al-Qaeda elements, for example, which happen to be among the most effective fighters in the opposition, is just silly. We don't have enough pro-American elements that they could win without the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda elements fighting with them side by side. And if you're going to empower Assad's opposition, you have to come to grips with the fact that that's who you're empowering, even if your intention is not to do that.
Andy McCarthy is our guest. He is, of course, the author of Willful Blindness, much in evidence at the moment, The Grand Jihad, also much in evidence, and Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. much in evidence as well. Andy, in addition to being a perspicacious author, of course, you have a lot of history with the justice system in the United States. And one of the things that I wanted to turn to in our closing minutes with you is the spectacle of Attorney General Eric Holder pursuing, in some ways, seemingly at odds with the Constitution, members of the press and the administration simultaneously saying, we need to be protected against these sorts of predations by having a very dubious piece of legislation called the Media Shield Act enacted. Give us your reading on what is going on here. Is this another case of no good crisis going to waste, or is there something more nefarious than that?
Yeah, it is a case of no good crisis going to waste, unfortunately. What I was concerned about with the Justice Department's overreach with respect to these investigations, and I don't think it's unconstitutional in principle to investigate members of the press who trade in classified information or who leak classified information. I think, you know, particularly when it's obvious that that information is going to be used to harm the United States. I was a critic of the fact that the Bush administration let all that stuff go without, you know, doing more and being more aggressive about the both, most importantly, the government people who do the leaking, but also the press people who irresponsibly publish that sort of information. I don't have a problem with that, but I think that what's gone on here is, you know, there are internal controls in the Justice Department to make sure that you don't go after the media for doing their job, and those have not been respected here. And what we're going to end up with is a bad piece of legislation that basically answers a problem that shouldn't be a problem, namely, how do you get information from the media, or under what circumstances can you get information from the media? Right now, the way the law is, you can get information from the media without restriction as far as subject matter is concerned, but internal Justice Department controls make sure it's the last thing that you try to do. And it's only done in very important circumstances. So you're relying on the discretion of responsible people. If you get a media shield law, basically Congress is going to prescribe ahead of time what categories of information you can go to the press for, and it'll basically just be times when there's a threat of violence or terrorism.
Limited in the extreme and may not cover the kinds of concerns that you've just described. Andy McCarthy, we have to let it go at that, I'm sorry to say. The time has flown by. We look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Thank you for the terrific work you're doing at National View and PJ Media and with us each week. Keep it up. We'll talk with you very soon. Next up, Bruce Bechtel talks about the North Korean regime and the threat they pose to all of us. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate, and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
When is America's day of reckoning? Dennis Prager wants to know.
We are robbing from the next generation to pay for this one. This is the America that we are inheriting
and that we are giving our children to inherit.
And you wonder, at what point will there be reckoning?
The Dennis Prager Show. Weekdays at noon, right before Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Air travel can be a nightmare, but Mike Gallagher says there are things that make it even worse.
I'm sitting on the plane, and there's this guy sitting across the aisle from me. Not only does he disgustingly take off his shoes and his socks, he gets up and goes into the bathroom barefooted. Do you know how nasty the floor is of the bathroom on an airplane?
The Mike Gallagher Show.
Ugh.
Weekdays at 9, right before Dennis Prager at noon on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. Bruce Bechtel. He is one of the country's leading experts on the Hermit Kingdom, one of the really exotic places in the world, North Korea. He is the author most recently of a new book entitled The Last Days of Kim Jong-il. It is a book, of course, about the previous regime in North Korea and has some very important insights into the one that we're dealing with now, led by one of Kim Jong-il's sons, Kim Jong-un. Bruce Bechtel, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You've spent a lot of time over the years, first in the Marine Corps for 20 years, and then as an analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency, studying, monitoring, trying to make sense of what these guys are up to in North Korea. Give us, if you would, a quick sort of sense of what the most important insights are about the regime there, specifically what we are likely to have seen imparted by Kim Jong-il to his son, Kim Jong-un.
Well, that's a very good question, and that's exactly what my new book is about. My assessment is that there is nothing going on right now that wasn't specifically planned for and kind of groundwork laid out for Kim Jong-un by his father and his cohorts in the Kim family regime, or KFR, as most of us call it. And there's five key things that I look at that I think are very relevant to what's happening now. And one is North Korea's evolving conventional military threat and the way Kim Jong-il got it ready the last 3 years of his regime after his stroke. Two is North Korea's evolving northern limit line strategy. That's the de facto DMZ off the West Coast in the water that they've had battles in over the past few years. Three is the nuclear capability that the North Koreans developed in the later years of Kim Jong-il's regime. Four is North Korea's support for terrorism and how that's done basically with a complete lack of ideology. It's strictly done to bring money into the coffers of the elite and support the military. And five, of course, is how the succession process plays in all of this and how it has played in all of this and is continuing to play in all of this. So I think for those who are interested in knowing how what's happened in the past 3 years is influencing what's happening right now, this will be a very relevant book.
Well, I'm sure of it. Let's start with your last point, Bruce Bechtol, the succession. It was not entirely a tidy affair, and there's a lot of reason to believe that Kim Jong-un has been very beholden to the military to ensure that he is, in fact, perpetuated as part of the Kim family dynasty. To what extent is his dependency on the military translating into more money, more latitude for the military to engage in some of the things that you've talked about with respect to provocations in the northern limit line, nuclear buildup, support for terrorism, and so on?
Well, that's a very good question. And it's also a question that it seems to be answered very tenuously right now, because there are four key institutions in the country that one must control in order to lead North Korea: the military, the security services, the party, and that Byzantine thing known as the Kim family inner circle. And his father and grandfather, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, both had absolute control over all those institutions. He does not. And this country has never functioned without an absolute leader, with the exception of about 6 months following Kim Jong-il's stroke. So the problem that exists now is the people running those institutions, who also have no power outside of those institutions, they do exactly what Kim Jong-un tells them to do. Well, what does he tell them to do? He tells them to do exactly what they tell him to tell them to do.
This is Byzantine.
Yes, sir. So we're living at, we're watching folks like yourself and I who watch national security affairs, we're watching the North Korean government at its most unstable since 1948.
Well,
and
this
that's
is
a very, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Under the best of circumstances, that would be an unpleasant thing. But when it is accompanied by, as you know so well, Bruce Bechtol, the threats that we've seen coming out of North Korea to this country, including that we would be attacked with nuclear weapons, backed up by, you know, videos and the like that suggest that they're actually seriously planning for this purpose. Should we take from your new book about, Kim Jong-il, the concern that indeed this instability could translate into war with the United States and certainly with its allies at the very least?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there's two things that we should take very seriously. War, of course, is one of them. The reason for that is because, quite simply, Kim Jong-un does not have the background or experience to lead that either his father or his grandfather had when they took the country over. So that's a major factor. If he gets caught off guard by some generals who have bad judgment, that could lead to escalation and conflict, or worse than that, you know, a full-scale war. That's a problem. I think another problem is simply the fact that he does not have full control over the key institutions in the country, and nobody does. That could lead to collapse. And that would also be, as you know, an equally difficult scenario for the United States and South Korea, because it would take hundreds of thousands of troops from both countries to stabilize that country and reunify the peninsula. So these are two things that we have on the horizon that could literally happen within the next 3 to 5 years, or they could happen next week, either one of those things.
Bruce Bechtel, let me ask you a question that arose in the course of a two-day conference held here in Washington last week about the threat of electromagnetic pulse attacks that could devastate this country by taking down our electrical grid and with it essentially every infrastructure that we depend upon for life in a 21st century society. It was noted by several people in the course of those 2 days that North Korea has been beavering away, of course, on nuclear weapons, and there is reason to believe that the Russians may have given them, or the Soviets before them, access to EMP weapons designs, in fact, perhaps even a super EMP weapons design, that if accompanied by long-range missiles or perhaps short-range missiles brought close to our shore by ship could constitute an existential threat to this country from North Korea. Do you have any knowledge of the validity of those concerns based upon your work at the Defense Intelligence Agency or other study of the matter? And if so, should this really ratchet up dramatically our notions, our concerns, our attentiveness at the very least to the threats of instability and perhaps worse coming out of North Korea under Kim Jong-un?
Well, again, a great question. I have seen, obviously all that I've seen since I departed the DIA in 2003 is unclassified data, but I have seen information on this that the North Koreans are working on EMP, and it usually takes them a number of years to work on anything, obviously, because of some of the technological challenges that they have due to being such an isolated nation. But, I would not be surprised if in coming years they were able to come up with some of this technology successfully, and I'll tell you why. Because, just 3 years ago we started seeing the North Koreans start to conduct cyber warfare and rather large-scale electronic warfare. And now, this is just within the past 3 years, we've seen them conduct successful cyber warfare operations against South Korean government websites, against South Korean newspapers, against South Korean entertainment websites, and they've done it on a massive scale. We've also seen them with new technology, anti-GPS technology, which they were able to use successfully last year. This is in my book, by the way, against not only planes trying to land at Incheon International Airport, but maritime craft out on the West Coast.
Wow. So, Bruce Bechtel, we're going to have to leave it at that. This is a fascinating subject with much, much more to cover with you, and I look forward to doing so and discussing the last days of Kim Jong-il, Bruce Bechtel's new book. We'll catch up with you again very soon, I hope, and we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.